I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Welcome to Spoiler Alert, episode 55 for August.
I'm Simon, and have you seen those posters for the new Bourne film that say Matt Damon as Jason Bourne?
Yeah.
I don't think he is. I think he's Matt Damon playing a character called Jason Bourne. Something about that really irritates me.
Yeah?
Yeah, I don't know why.
You think they're trying to just reinforce that he is Bourne after they went, hey, it's not Jeremy Renner?
Yeah, but Jeremy Renner wasn't Bourne, was he?
No.
He was someone else.
I guess not.
We all know Matt Damon plays Jason Bourne, don't we?
Yeah.
You remember this.
Yeah, maybe Jeremy Renner's like the George Lazenby of the Bourne films, and they were like, oh, that didn't work out too well.
He's the George Lazenby of most films.
I'm Duncan, and if you wanted to watch Poltergeist, Goonies, E.T., and A Nightmare on Elm Street all at the same time, you could put them on four different TVs at once, or you could just put on one screen that's showing TV show Stranger Things.
Yeah, I get it. I need to see this.
So, if you haven't been watching that, what have you been watching, Simon?
Oh, okay. Well, look. My first introduction to the gorgeous and melodramatic so-called women's pictures of Douglas Sirk, The sumptuous all that heaven allows.
Mm-hmm.
Jane Wyman, well-heeled, widowed, falls for her younger gardener, Rock Hudson, and has to confront the disapproval of her family and friends. I love this film.
Right.
Yeah, I really did. It's a gorgeous colour palette and in a way subtler than you'd expect, satire of American conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
I followed it up with the gentle drama The Wails of August, starring the oldest actress to ever star in a film.
Wow.
Lillian Gish, who was 93 when the film came out back in 87.
Mm-hmm.
Her co-stars are a youthful Betty Davis, a mere 79,
mm-hmm.
playing her sister, and Vincent Price as a potential suitor, a sprightly 78.
Oh, wow.
I enjoyed this immensely, despite it being a very small film of intimate moments rather than, sweeping drama.
Mm-hmm.
I finally caught up with Deadpool, the smart-ass superhero film which otherwise plays by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny in parts, and I admire Reynolds for getting it made, but the structure kind of didn't work for me.
Right.
Essentially, the first action scene doesn't end for about an hour.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird, thanks to the film's choppy flashbacks. And the final confrontation with the slightly underwhelming villain didn't really do it for me either.
Yeah. When I got to the final kind of climactic scene, it dawned on me, you didn't have much money for this, did you?
Totally. And I get why they did it, but it means the first hour takes that action scene to happen. And then... Yeah. The next action scene, the confrontation, it's shortly after.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's kind of unusual.
Yeah.
It's clever in a way, but I think it just goes on too long.
Yep.
So the first of my month's horror films was a low-budget arthouse zombie film that just happened to star one Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wow.
Yeah, Maggie is undeniably a unique experience. Mm-hmm. It looks great. Performances are solid all around, including Abigail Breslin as the infected daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But it really does lack novelty. There are genuinely no scenes you won't see coming, no surprises in the script you can't see coming at all, and no tension to what's going to happen. It's really lovely. It's just quite empty.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how the hell it took me until 2016 to finally watch the bonkers horror film from Dario Argento, Phenomena. Jennifer Connelly is a sleepwalking foreign exchange student who witnesses a murder she can't remember. Donald Pleasance is a wheelchair-bound bug boffin with a murderous chimp. There's a mutant killer kid, and none of this gets to the strangest thing about this film at all. Connolly can communicate with insects via ESP. So, it's mad.
It is.
And I loved it, obviously, because
it
is mad.
Yeah.
It steals from Suspiria and just about anything else that Argento had done earlier.
Yeah.
But it's bonkers.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah, yeah. I watched this not that long ago. And,
I remember you saying, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It is, and how much itself referenced is, quite striking, really.
Yeah, when she shows up to the school at the beginning, very much like the girl from Suspiria, there's even a little voiceover introduction as it was in Suspiria just to, set the scene.
Yeah.
And so many murders that nobody seems to be bothered about, really.
Yeah, that's right.
That school should have been closed down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got so many good films piling up to watch, and yet I chose to waste my time on a slasher musical starring Meatloaf. Not horror enough to be a horror film. I'm talking about Stage Fright.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard about it. Not horror enough to be a horror film, and not musical enough to appeal as a musical. It's a film that starts with a bang, with Minnie Driver meeting a gruesome end, for a decent funny song and dance number. But then it's a full 40 minutes before we get any more scares. And the musical numbers aren't strong enough to carry that slack as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's an oddity for sure. You know, I mean, how often do you claim to watch a musical horror film starring Meatloaf? It's just not a very good film.
Yeah.
It's kind of just a missed opportunity, actually.
Yeah.
More than anything else. Apparently, Stephen King is a big fan of the 1976 haunted house film Burnt Offerings, which I watched this month. And I can see why. It's a similar film to The Shining in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
But without the things that King hated about Kubrick's adaptation.
Yeah.
You know? Oliver Reed is really great.
Mm-hmm.
Karen Black is solid.
Yeah.
And it's fun. We were talking about this just off camera before, to see Bette Davis in a later film role as well. It's way too long, though.
Yeah.
And it's also a little bit predictable, but I kind of enjoyed the hell out of it. Mm-hmm. It's got a great... a twist ending you'll see coming, but then it's followed by a shocking moment of violence, which you'll giggle at.
Yeah.
So, quite enjoyed that, actually.
Oh, cool. I must check that out. I was just thinking about Karen Black today, because she was in everything in the 70s, wasn't she?
She sure was.
And then she just disappeared.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she kind of declined, and I actually Wikipedia just today, because I was like, whatever happened to her?
What was the last thing she did? House of 1,000 Corpses?
Yeah, that's right. She died not long ago. She was everywhere in the 70s.
Yep.
She was in, like, you know... Day of the Locusts and Five Easy Pieces, Easy Rider, Family Plot, you know, Hitchcock's one.
Yeah.
Like, it's just in everything.
Yeah,
and
she sure was.
Kind of go from that to being cast in everything, you know, to disappearing.
Yeah, it's a strange thing.
Yeah.
So, and then just a couple of my film festival screenings. Okay. So, an Iranian ghost story set during the Iran-Iraq War.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Under the Shadow. It made great use of its unfamiliar setting, particularly for Western eyes anyway,
mm-hmm.
And the twin dangers of missile attacks and political and cultural oppression really helped ratchet up the fear and keep you off balance. It's a fine film. But even as I watched it, I found myself reminded of the Japanese ghost story Dark Water,
mm-hmm.
and that to me is one of the greatest supernatural horror films, you know, of them all. I love that film so much.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a tough comparison to be forced to make in your head, you know what I mean? So as much as I really enjoyed this film, there's a part of me thinking, oh, you were very similar to a much, much superior film, you know?
Yeah.
And lastly, Swiss Army Man.
Oh.
The thoroughly charming story of Paul Dano and his farting companion corpse buddy played by Daniel Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
This was great stuff, and I don't really want to talk much more about it, because I think any further plot details, you know, could spoil your enjoyment. Just go see it, I reckon.
Yeah, definitely one I want to check out.
Mm.
And it was a bit of a call of mine not to go and see that at the festival this time around.
Sure.
So, yeah. But I figured it might come back to Rialto, perhaps.
Yeah, I got a feeling it will.
Yeah.
It was really popular. I know they put on a another encore screening.
That's
because,
right.
Because it proved so popular.
Mm.
How about yourself, Duncan? What have you been watching?
Quite a few. Palindromes. Todd Solondz goes for broke in his embracing of all things arthouse and confronting. Making a film about abortion and pedophilia, replete with the lead character being played by 8 different actors. A house of handicapped children singing choreographed religious pop songs, and the director's most beloved character committing suicide before the opening credits have rolled and being eulogized about as delicately and kindly as you would expect from the creator of Happiness.
Mm.
Speaking of abortions, Dumplings, a Hong Kong film about Bailing's ex-doctor cooking up dumplings made from fetuses and serving them to a vain rich woman desperate to attract her cheating husband. Unfortunately, the film flails, never delivering on its promise, but Bai Ling is Looney Tunes fun, while the sound design is disgustingly perfect, and the magnificent Christopher Doyle is on camera duties.
I have never heard of this film.
Yeah, so it's narratively, it just really doesn't deliver. It's really underwhelming. But Christopher Doyle, I mean, I was just like, I saw his name on the credits, and yeah, I was just like,
You knew you were going to see something good. Yeah,
it was shot really nicely. 2 more Simon Lambert recommendations this month. The Gift, Joel Edgerton's classy little thriller with the unveiling of Jason Bateman's character, real highlight of the script.
Yeah.
Really good. And A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Shot like a European neo-realist film from the 50s, this is engaging and effectively shot chilling vampire film that makes great use of eerily sparse urban locations in Iran to portray the isolation of its troubled characters. The first half particularly really good in the lead. You know, she's really striking, especially visually with the burqa on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They use that really well to fit in with the kind of vampire.
Yeah. Movie. Yeah. Yeah.
10 Cloverfield Lane.
Okay.
Yeah. A spiritual sequel to the Handycam monster film Cloverfield. And Mary Elizabeth Winstead does everything in the first 7 minutes of being captured that you wish Brie Larson did in any part of the 7 years she was stuck in Rome.
Mm.
John Goodman plays the edgy survivalist who has either perfectly predicted an alien takeover or is a paranoid kidnapper. The first half hour is a lot of tense fun finding out which is which almost makes up for the absurdity of the final 20 minutes.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, I've had this fun sitting there thinking, oh, I've got to watch this at some time.
Yeah, it's enjoyable, and I think you really get on side with the lead.
Right.
And what's interesting is how silent she is, though. She's quite laconic. She's the laconic one out of the characters that are in there. It's really interesting. A few Italian films and two at the film festival. Perfect Strangers. A group of married friends have dinner and play a game. They're keeping their cell phones on the table. Every text is to be read out and every call answered on speakerphone for all to hear. This film got the most vocal reactions of the festival for me. Laughter drowning out dialogue. Ooze during the revelations. It was a great cinema experience, actually. Like a play, the film has many contrived artifices which occur very neatly, but it has such a uniformly good cast at various times, both sympathetic and pathetic. And when the last hit, they were with real considerable force. The premise is also one that is immediately relatable and likely to have anyone who watches it, whether they liked the film or not, to have definite opinions about the game and whether they themselves would survive it unscathed. If you do want to watch it, I would just say watch it before the inevitable American remake.
Uh-huh.
Like, I honestly, I was like halfway through this going, they're going to remake this.
Right.
And sure enough, I've heard that they are.
Yeah.
Another festival film, Like Crazy, from one of my favorite modern Italian directors, Paolo Verzi. He's the master of the coming-of-age story, but here he conjures a 1-2 punch of performances from Valeria Bruni-Tedeschi as a rich, eccentric socialite deprived of her money, and Michaela Ramazzotti, a suicidal loner deprived of her son. The pair seem doomed to be stuck in a rut of self-absorbed mania and depression until they realize their influence on each other may be their salvation. While the story's a little ho-hum and the backstory is very predictable, the performances are excellent. Bruni is brilliant in quite a Blue Jasmine-like performance, and it really is one of those roles that actors must drool over. While the opposite performance is a little bit less showy, but kind of has more of the emotionally rewarding nature to it, to the viewer. Yeah, I liked it. I think narratively, it's probably not too, you know, you kind of know where it's going. You've seen it before, so it's kind of like a Thelma and Louise in a mental institution kind of thing. So, but the performances are good. And, you know, Verzi, he's a humanist above all, but also a director able to shift styles and delivery of message impressively from film to film. And also Italian, but not at the festival, Mamma Roma. Pasolini's second film, built around the unique force of nature that was Anna Magnani as an ex-prostitute trying to raise her estranged country boy son in 60s urban Rome. The usual Pasolini preoccupations of the new lower classes developing from the ashes of fascist Italy wrapped up in religious imagery. Considering Pasolini's later work, this is comparatively subtle, but embracing what at the time must have been pretty racy topics with singular confidence. The film's very overwrought at times, but worth watching for Magnani's performance and some brilliant cinematography, particularly the unbroken single-shot night scenes as Magnani wanders the streets questioning life aloud. And then finally, on the closing night of the film festival, Paul Verhoeven's L. Controversy and Verhoeven go arm-in-arm, and this questionable tale of rape could only be delivered by the Mad Dutchman. And like his best work, this is most effective giving dark laughs. But Isabella Huppert is the reason any of this works. She's just hypnotic in her disaffected performance as she searches for the identity of her attacker who continues to torment her after the opening brutality. The mystery element holds little surprises. Like, there's this kind of revelation, and there's actually a couple of pockets of people going, oh, yeah. And I actually went, come on. Like, you know, it's just like,
yeah.
You got to be kidding me. Like, this is the most obvious thing ever. but the lead's reactions, they do hold surprises. And this is where the debate will really begin with this film. By the end of it, you'll probably be asking what the point of it was and what any of the gender politics ends up meaning, other than women endure a lot of physical and emotional brutality at the hands of men's base desires. But also in the end, they do endure. And it's kind of an interesting one to come out of. I saw a friend of the show, trademark, Darren Bevan, at this, and he just, it was the last film he'd gone to see 32 films at the film festival.
Yeah. Yep.
And he looked exhausted. He's like, I don't even know where to begin with that one. So I'll see you later. But yeah, so that was my month.
Wow.
Is it safe?
You're talking to me?
Is it safe?
To what safe?
Is it safe?
So, Duncan Eastwood, what's the news?
Well, look, seeing as it's election fever in the States, it's no surprise that it's rubbed off on Hollywood a little. With the more important decision for the American people, which alien film do you fall behind? Michael Fassbender is trying to lure people burnt by Prometheus with the promise that a sequel will quote, be scarier. Which won't be difficult, because Noomi Rapace's self-applied alienectomy aside, the film was dangerously light on frights. In contrast to this measured assurance from Fassbender, Sigourney Weaver is going the full Trump by promising that Neil Blomkamp's script will, quote, give the fans everything they are looking for. Which means to me, as a longtime fan, that this will be the best alien film ever, plus a personal appearance by the cast at the premiere handing out free ice cream and popcorn. Make LV-426 great again.
Yeah, nice one. You're the first person to probably ever compare Sigourney Weaver with Donald Trump.
Yeah, I'm sure she'd be stoked.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy, these two films coming out.
I know that the Blomkamp's one's been pushed back
quite
significantly, so who knows when it's going to come out. But yeah, so Weaver sounds really hyped about it.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
This month we said our final goodbye to the VCR, the machine that changed the world and definitely changed our world.
How is this not on the tree? Why?
What, the VCR's no longer around?
Yeah.
I've still got mine, so that's why it's not on the tree away yet.
Yeah.
When mine breaks down, tree away.
Yeah.
But the whole podcast will just be one long extended rant about the fact that I can't get new heads for my VCR.
You'll just be like Mad Max, just out there searching for oil.
In the wastelands.
Yeah.
Homing the wastelands. Before the VCR, there were only two ways to watch movies. At the cinema, or whenever the two channels of the time aired them, with ads and everything. Unless it was Sunday, of course. Mm-hmm. Since there were no ads on a Sunday. Do you remember that?
I do.
I can remember taping Star Wars because they played it on a Sunday night.
Yep.
So I just clear run.
Yeah.
Perfect. But with the VCR, a hulking mechanical beast that cost thousands of dollars, and the birth of the video store, a whole world of choice opened up for us. We eagerly gobbled up the work of filmmakers we could only read about beforehand and discovered all sorts of weird gems, many of which only existed to fill the bare shelves of our local video stores. Of course, VCRs would give way to DVD and Blu-ray and now to Ultra HD, a format surely as good as dead as soon as it hit the market.
Yeah.
I mean, really? Ultra HD?
It was the Betamax, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's too late, you know?
Yeah.
There'll be a handful of real cinemaphiles who'll go, ooh, I've got to have this. The rest of us, we'll forget about it.
Yeah.
We'll just be, you know, stealing movies on our computers.
Yeah.
But for some peculiar reason, these wildly complex machines stayed in production until now. Despite the fact that the last VHS movie to get a release was Eragon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, back in 2007.
Wow.
Hmm.
That's a good fact to know.
Yeah, there you
store
go.
Store that one away for a quiz night one
yeah,
time.
Exactly. What was the last movie? Yeah, Eragon.
And that was an Eragon.
Yes. You're just a second ahead of me on that one. I suddenly realised, hey, wait, there's a joke here. A really terrible pun to be made.
Duncan will beat me.
Duncan.
Is nothing sacred, Simon? It seems not. Because that mega hit, genre-defining, cultural touchstone, Flatliners, is being rebooted. Yes, that 1990 film from when Julia Roberts was the It Girl. But in all seriousness, Flatliners is the kind of film that should be remade or rebooted or rejigged or reread. No one cares about this. They care about Psycho remakes. They'll even cry over Point Break remakes. But no one cares about Flatliners because it's supposed to be a sequel and starring Elaine Page and Kiefer Sutherland as his same morally questionable doctor from the original. I guess I couldn't get Billy Baldwin. So, yeah.
It almost sounds like she's playing your Inception character in a way.
Yeah, yeah. But I was thinking this is actually probably something that will be one of those few ones that will actually improve on the original.
Yeah, potentially. I don't remember the original being great.
No.
So, you know, it doesn't also cry out to be remade or rebooted or sequeled either. So.
No. But it's not a bad idea of like just going, oh, there's something and I can see how you could vastly improve on that concept of what you're doing.
Yeah, sure.
And yeah,
I'm completely indifferent to this news.
Yeah, I know. I literally saw it today, and I was like, Flatliners. I haven't thought about that since I was like 15.
A while back, I caught an eerie trailer for a film called The Woods. Mm-hmm. It did that trick that loads of trailers do now of using an old pop song slowed down and made all creepy. You know, In this case, it was Every Breath You Take, you know?
Which is creepy to begin with anyway.
Yeah, it really is stalky, eh? Actually, that's a good point. At least this one's they've chosen the right song. It also had loads of very impressive sound and critic quotes all over the trailer. This month, a new trailer came out for The Woods. And hey, what do you know? The Woods has a new title as well. Yeah. It's now known as Blair Witch.
Oh.
Yep. Which makes it the official sequel to the groundbreaking 1999 horror, The Blair Witch Project. The Blair Witch Project obviously had a sequel back in 2000 called Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2. But everyone hated that film.
Yeah, and I always get it confused with that Sherlock Holmes sequel.
Book of Shadows.
Game of Shadows. I always call it that.
Yep. So this is big news, especially since it's getting such great reviews. Mm. And it's directed by Adam Wingard, who also helmed The Guest, which obviously I loved because I talked about it a couple of months ago. So I'm cautiously very optimistic.
Oh, that's excellent. That's good, big news. I hadn't heard of that.
Yeah, yeah. It's just weird that they did this whole bait and switch where the first trailer made you think, oh, I'm going to get this. And
yeah.
But it must have really sworn people to secrecy because there were critic quotes all over it. So the critics must have seen it and then they're like, don't tell anyone this is actually The Blair Witch.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I guess they're going for, you know, just the same way that they sold that film. Maybe that's the way they marketed it.
Totally, totally. It is capturing in a way some of that spirit of how they, yeah.
So Ben Wheatley is on a prolific streak. His sixth film in 7 years, Free Fire, is apparently his most accessible film concerning Brie Larson as the mediator of an arms deal between two Irishmen and a gang. Set in the 70s with an impressive cast alongside the recent Oscar winner Larson of Arnie Hammer, Sharlto Copley, Sam Riley, and Cillian Murphy looking like an almost famous level appropriateness for the era of the 70s. Like, you look at him and he just looks like Billy Cudrip does in Almost Famous. I was like, ah, that guy is born to be in the 70s film. The film is described as an action thriller and exec produced by Scorsese, and it was also apparently a bit of a bidding war to get this released. So it's safe to say Wheatley has hit the mainstream not a moment too soon. I'm interested to see what he does.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. All those good actors and Sharlto Copley as well. Look, you're okay. It's fine. Look, watching Evil Dead 2 is one of the best times you can have at the movies, as far as I'm concerned. It is without a doubt the film I've rewatched more in my lifetime than any other movie.
Wow.
The Raiders of the Lost Ark would come a very close second, I think. Mm-hmm. And perhaps I've watched moments of Raiders more, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But you know what would be really groovy? Getting to grab your trusty boomstick yourself, wedge the old chainsaw onto your wrist stump, and go storming off down to the cellar to carve yourself a witch. Which is what you'll soon be able to do if the Evil Dead 2 board game Kickstarter goes ahead. And it looks like it is. Complete with a cabin board, miniatures, including, I'm very pleased to say, a goosenecked Henrietta, and Book of the Dead style box, the Evil Dead 2 board game will let you deal to deadites while rolling dice, sadly only six-sided, while eating chips and drinking Coke with your buddies on a Sunday evening. Yeah, the only thing I feel bad about is I said boomstick, a term that was introduced in the Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
And we don't really care for that much. But Evil Dead 2, I love the fact they've made it the Evil Dead 2 board game, not Evil Dead board game or specifically that movie.
The Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
That's great. I'm a huge board game fan, so as you know, so I'm looking forward to getting that.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
Is it safe?
I don't know what you mean.
I can't tell you if something is safe or not unless I know specifically what you're talking about.
Is it safe?
And now we're up to No Comps, where we go and see a latest release. This time it was at the film festival, and we saw Green Room, directed by Jeremy Saulnier, starring Anton Yelchin, Imogen Poots, Alia Shawkat, and Patrick Stewart.
A punk rock band so down on their luck that they're stealing petrol and accepting headlining gigs, but they're actually the only band on the card, perform at a skinhead bar where they witness a murder. Hold up in the bar's green room, they now have to survive the neo-Nazi gang led by a menacing Patrick Stewart who have them trapped and try to find a way to escape.
Mm.
Really as simple as that.
It is, yeah. It's pretty straightforward. But Green Room ignores the actual punk music, instead choosing to portray the pogoing, thrashing experience in slow motion, set to a moody but quiet score. Or in one striking scene, the needle is dropped on vinyl for half a second of music and then jump cuts to the needle rubbing on the inner sleeve to indicate the night has long since finished. Mm. Even for a punk fan like me, I was encouraged by this. Rather than drowning proceedings in like a super cool Repo Man-esque soundtrack of, say, like The Stooges, Misfits, Minor Threat, Bad Brains, Black Flag, the film only uses one solid punk song and is a catalyst for the narrative in many ways, the Dead Kennedys' Nazi Punks Fuck Off is the song the band decide to play as their opening, quietly murmuring at its climax through a hail of spit and bottles. That was a cover.
Yeah. Ballsy.
Yeah, very ballsy.
This is the third in my accidental trilogy of Nazi films.
Yeah.
I was thinking that. So I started 2 months ago with Come and See, was followed by Son of Saul, and now ends in Bloodshed in the back of the worst bar in cinema history, probably.
Yeah.
Next month, we'll no doubt go and review a nice, gentle rom-com that turns out to be a neo-Nazi love story.
Yeah.
Yeah, just surprisingly, out of nowhere. It's also the third film in as many months it could accurately be described as a punch to the guts.
Mm-hmm.
The Green Room is a well-oiled tension machine. The setup, the murder, everything takes place in the tightly wound opening 20 minutes. It's also a very simple setup, a pure siege film that works because it appears for quite some time that anything can and will happen,
mm-hmm.
That anyone could be killed at a moment's notice, and quite brutally as well.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a punk assault on Precinct 13. The film has the fortune of casting the late Anton Yelchin in its lead role. He was one of the most naturally sympathetic actors around. For further evidence, see his turn in 2011's Fright Night remake, or taking away the acting honours in Terminator Salvation as a young Kyle Reese. He has an innate goodness about him that allows the dissension into fevered hacking and slashing madness to always kind of contain a moral centre.
Mm.
While Imogene Poots as the traitor to the Nazi cause is the unflappable voice of both reason and doom. Patrick Stewart doesn't attempt an accent, but he does get one standout sequence where he calmly tries to talk Yelchin and his band into surrendering.
Yeah.
Walking the tightrope of duality by offering hope while explaining the hopelessness of the situation. It's a really, really well-written scene and one that sets Stewart up, but I kind of felt that it fails to use him beyond that much more.
Yeah, I got to agree. Like, I think he plays it well.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of this unnerving calm. He seems very plausible as kind of the measured face of hate, you know?
Yeah.
Not a ranting, spitting, you know, face, but you kind of, yeah, I got to feel you're right about that. I also thought the tension peels back a fraction in the last third.
Yeah.
You know? As the film takes a less cruel, more action-orientated route to the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. You probably won't mind, I think. Mm-hmm. You'll surely feel the characters who have survived to that point deserve to be in a more heroic film at that point, you know?
Yeah.
Where the bad guys don't necessarily shoot when they should, and the good guys have luck on their side a bit more. But it does feel as if at that point in the film we drift into a slightly different film.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, look, Green Room may appear to have something on its mind initially, perhaps something about idealism or nihilism or truth, but what it is revealed is that it does not. Its only interest is in being a thriller that succeeds in making squirm in your seat brutality. The shocks are startling and the deaths are vicious. No mercy is paid to any character, and the modes of death, the weapons of choice, shall we say, make for a nice change of pace in this gun-obsessed country.
Mm.
But the film seems to kind of run out of steam. And ending what I thought was a bit of a whimper rather than a bang, the film ambling like it's hobbling battered characters to a bit of a vacant and empty conclusion for me.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think it comes from a place where it did feel surprising and it did feel like anything could happen at any time. I mean, there's a scene where a character seems like he's about to save the day or at least turn and immediately get shot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it makes you think, wow, anything could happen in this film. But ultimately, really, that's not the case.
Yeah.
And that last, maybe it's 20 minutes, really reinforced that's not the case. Coming to much more stable sort of action territory.
Yeah, and I think it kind of comes to a conclusion where it almost feels like in the writing process, you'd be like, well, what do we do now? You know what I mean? Like, and I don't think they ever kind of wrote themselves out of that to be anything. At the end of it, you were like, oh, well, kind of...
Yeah.
You know, I feel exhausted by all of that, but there we go. You know what I mean? Like, and like you say, the moments of the pressure cooker stuff was great.
Yeah. There's this whole thing where the green room is like, so it's their sanctuary, but it's also kind of such a hell, you know, for most of that film. They're kind of safe there, but they're also trapped. And I think one of the things I did like is how mercilessly they tease that. Several times they kind of make an escape and then are kind of driven back into the green room. And every time that happens, I think, oh, God, just get out of that room.
Yeah.
You know, it's so awful. It's excruciating. Mm. That part where Imogen Poots just gets that knife and just slices a man's belly.
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah.
Wow. I thought she was great, by the way.
Yeah, she was. She was very good.
And I think nothing for me says Grimm so much as the introduction of dogs into the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, once the dogs came on, I was like, oh, a little part of me.
Yeah. And I think that the dogs part, that was that, and maybe to a lesser extent the hacking and slashing, that I liked that it didn't, that it kind of rained back on the guns, because when you start introducing guns into this, then you're like, well, okay. It turns into a bit of a actioner, and whereas with the guns, with the knives and the dogs, it stays very much in the kind of horror almost thriller area rather than the action thriller area.
Yeah, the Assault on 13, Precinct 13 comparison, and Straw Dogs as well.
That's right.
Not out of place, I think.
Yeah. I also like to say that it's good to see a female member of an otherwise all-male band being the lead guitarist. So often they're consigned to bass.
Right.
And I really like that.
You've given by far the most musical review of this.
Yeah. I like that. I was like, oh, here we go. Here's maybe from Arrested Development, and she's going to be the bass player. Or maybe at a push, she might be the drummer. But she was just a lead guitarist, so I like that.
I got to say that, I pretty much really like this film. I loved his previous film. I don't know if anyone out there has seen Sornia's previous film, Blue Ruin, from 2013. There's this talk of the colour trilogy, like Blue Ruin, followed by the Green Room. And Green Room's very green as well. I mean, it's colour palette, and Blue Ruin is very blue as well. It has this riveting, largely wordless opening 20 minutes leading up to a messy, close quarters, botched murder. And it's a film that keeps you off balance even far more effectively, I thought, than Green Room. Mm-hmm. It also stars Macon Blair, who was the most sympathetic of the Green Room's neo-Nazis, without giving away too much. Mm. Very effective in Blue Ruin. So I think that's actually maybe even a better place to start. Or if you like Green Room, definitely go and check out Blue Ruin. Sornia himself talks about these films as being as idiots in bad situations films. You know, people just having to deal with horrible, horrible situations that are ill-equipped. Yeah. With, which is fairly accurate.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a very lean film. Overall, Green Room has a brilliant second act. It takes its time getting its characters in the titular location, but the middle third of the movie uses inventive ways to keep them in there. Either side of it, it didn't really excite me, but that middle 30 minutes is like what the edge of your cinema seat was created for.
Yeah.
You know, that was excellent. Totally. I was totally riveted at that.
Yeah, look, I'm going to agree with you. I think that's the second third of the film is probably the strongest. But I maybe enjoyed the first part as well a bit more than you. Mm-hmm. The opening felt like, for me, a vivid look into a counterculture, you know, the struggling punk band. That felt fresh and actually kind of funny at times, which was nice, you know. There's a scene where the van driver falls asleep and they just, you know, that shot that reveals that's really lovely. And I like the band's disdain for social media, even if it means nobody knows who they are, you know. Once the carnage begins, some of the narrative invention is actually lost, because I don't know how much we know about how that the gang outside works, if you know what I mean. It becomes a really well-staged piece of mayhem, and it becomes a very good siege film, and ultimately I think a less novel action revenge film in the last act. I enjoyed it quite a bit in the moment as a sinister bloody rollercoaster ride, though.
Yeah, and I think to be in the cinema, and we went and saw it at different sessions, didn't we?
Yeah.
But the audience was really responding to some of the shocks and the brutality. And and like you say, when the dogs get introduced, everyone's kind of, you can hear the kind of nervous groan in the audience, like, oh, no.
Oh, I think I just let out a nervous exhale when the dogs appeared as well.
But, overall, I definitely recommend checking out Green Room. It's good.
Yeah, I would too, but I'd also say give Blue Ruin a go.
Yeah, I will next.
Yes, it's safe. It's very safe. It's so safe you wouldn't believe it.
Is it safe?
No, it's not safe. It's very dangerous. Be careful.
And now we're on to the top five. Actors always say the villain is more fun to play than the hero. Yet some actors seem like they have always been the good guy. Their image and career built on being a paragon of virtue. But what happens when the White Knights swap their shining armor for black hats? Well, then you get our top five good guys gone bad.
Outside of Darth Vader, there is one movie villain I remember clearly and fondly as a youngster. A raggedy-maned, wild-eyed man in his 60s with pecs that wouldn't quit and a name that can be said, but it's really best not said, rather remembered by the way William Shatner bellowed it theatrically in the second and probably best Star Trek film. I'm, of course, talking about Khan Noonan Singh in Star Trek The Wrath of Khan. Mm-hmm. A villain in the 60s TV series, Khan returned to terrorize the crew of the Enterprise in 1982. And what a terror. Khan was Kirk's ultimate adversary. Still the only Star Trek villain I remember by name. He plants hideous worms, space worms or something. Some Star Trek fan out there will probably be wincing when I say that. Into the air canals of several of Kirk's crew. Devastates the Enterprise and forces Spock to make a heartbreaking sacrifice. All of this from a character who never once appears in the same location as the hero. Which is an amazing thing.
It is.
Yeah. And yet, like most people, I knew the actor playing Khan, Ricardo Montalban, from only one other performance. As a kid, I'd grown used to seeing Montalban on the small screen, smiling benignly and wearing a crisp white suit while welcoming visitors to Fantasy Island, where their dreams would come true, and they'd learn some important life lessons as well.
Yeah.
He was the epitome of a kindly, almost saintly man, and perhaps it's that dignity turned to murderous pride that makes his transformation to villain so powerful. Or maybe it's just that Montalban had a juicy role and he delivered a career-defining performance to go with it. Mm. Either way, his villain has turned towers over the franchise so thoroughly that the next two films in the series would spend their time unpicking the damage Khan had caused. And the more recent Star Trek Into Darkness would feel compelled to bring the character back with vastly diminishing returns.
Yeah. I remember that. And I remember that ear bug thing, that earwig thing.
Terrifying.
Crazy.
Terrifying.
Yeah. Remember that vividly. Yeah, I guess I don't know Montalban from anything else other than Fantasy Island and Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
I can't think of
it. No, he's been around a long time, but, you know, a lot of Westerns in his past and a fair bit of television as well. But absolutely, those two roles. That's it.
My first one is Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West. Is this just yet another chance to speak about my favourite Western film of all time? Perhaps. But Henry Fonda's casting as one of the most ruthless Western villains was inspired, and not exactly the done thing at the time. Stunt casting was unusual in 1968. Sure, you might have your upstart method actors playing anti-heroes, your character actors switching, but lead actors? They were heroes. John Wayne or Jimmy Stewart were going to be good guys until the day they died. But Fonda wasn't just a good guy. He was the embodiment of John Steinbeck's voice of the downtrodden, the lone fighter for justice in 12 Angry Men, and even the most revered of all presidents, Abraham Lincoln. Here, he was massacring families with a smile on his face, playing Frank, a sadistic killer traversing the Wild West like a snake, silent and deadly until erupting into violence. And all because Sergio Leone had a very different idea and chased a reluctant Fonda until he convinced him. Even having vision beyond the great actors, because when Fonda appeared on set with contacts to make his eyes black, Leone protested, saying, "No, I want the audience to see these horrible acts you commit and then see those like soulful baby blue eyes. Mm. The world is known as good and righteous and realize they belong to the perpetrator."
Mm.
And that may be a common thing now, but you've got to take it back to then. And that was really unheard of.
It's a compelling performance now.
It's incredible. Yeah. Yeah. And for Fonda, I mean, like I say, you know, you think about that guy and he was the real kindly guy of, you know, maybe Jimmy Stewart along those lines as well. But as far as an idealistic actor, he was right up there.
Oh, that's so perfect. What a great choice.
Yeah.
Look, most of the actors on this list have probably turned to the dark side, either to change up their careers, to have a crack at the sort of parts they never get, or become because some canny filmmaker saw the potential, as Leone did, in shocking audiences by showing them a beloved actor playing it being bad. But my next pick is a little bit different. He's an actor whose sudden jackknife from sex symbol action hero to toxic Hollywood burnout meant that bad guys were pretty much the only role he could plausibly play. I'm, of course, referring to Mel Gibson. In my youth, Mel was the ultimate action star. He was ridiculously sexy, whether he was patrolling the wastelands wearing leather pants and wielding a sawn or shotgun, or patrolling LA wearing a mullet and wielding a too-old-for-this-shit Danny Glover. But his appeal was to blokes as much as it was to the ladies, which is a difficult thing, I think. He was funny, and he seemed tough in the era of juiced-up Stallones and Arnies, which was no mean feat. Gradually, he remodeled himself as an acclaimed director while still being a big-screen good guy, as he painted himself half-blue and threatened to shoot thunderbolts from his butt to free Scotland, or something.
Yeah.
But all of that changed with one appalling and yet often hilarious, I think, sexist and anti-Semitic drunken explosion. Maybe Mel could have come back from that, but as it turned out, blaming the Jews for the world's woes while charmingly calling a female police officer sugar tits wasn't a bizarre explosion from an otherwise decent human being, but merely the bitter tip of the iceberg from a man with some deplorable views and seemingly serious anger issues. As stories of vile opinions expressed and recordings of angry, drunken threats emerged, the heroic Mel of old faded away a little in our collective cinematic memories. A friend of mine likes to say, you get the face you deserve. I'm not sure if that's true, but it seemed to me Mel was getting the face that revealed the man underneath. Still ruggedly good looking, perhaps, but with cold eyes and a perma scowl that seems to be perpetually on the edge of screaming, hey, fuck you, buddy. This wasn't the face of a good guy anymore, which is what makes him perfect for the Expendables 3. The flabbiest, most misguided of the three late-era Stallone vanity vehicles that gave him an excuse to hang out with his action star pals of old. The Expendables 3 is pretty dire.
Yeah.
Its midsection is particularly rough, as Sly and Fraser Crane drive around the States putting together the new young Expendables team that no one who paid to see this movie cared about for a second. No one. But its one bright spot comes from Gibson getting to unload on Stallone and the now de rigueur bad guy imprisoned by the good guys and getting to verbally turn the tables on them scene before escaping, obviously. Mm-hmm. That is in at least a film a year these days, it feels like. Mm-hmm. It's a big, juicy, scenery-chewing monologue that uses Gibson's venomous delivery to pretty great effect, and it's almost the only sort of role I can kind of imagine him playing at this point. Mm-hmm. Time will tell whether his lead role in the upcoming Bloodfather will show me that Gibson can play good guys again, but I suspect he's going to be a fairly compromised hero for kind of anyone to accept him.
Yeah. I think he's definitely painted himself into a corner there, hasn't he?
Yeah, he really has. Yeah. And like I say, I don't know if there's not, I'm not saying there's no way out as an actor. I bought him enough in The Expendables, you know, even though that's a terrible film. And I could probably buy him The Bloodfather, but he's going to be a fairly dark sort of hero, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's an anti-hero, if anything.
Yeah. Sir Laurence Olivier had played Shakespearean villains like Richard III before, but even the old royal hunchback would be giving his kingdom for an anaesthetic when faced with Olivier's dentist from The Marathon Man. Olivier is calm, controlled, and ruthless, dispatching Roy Schneider's agent with a knife to the stomach before a breathless sequence when he interrogates a clueless Dustin Hoffman with the legendary line, "Is it safe?" Three innocuous words have never led to so much pain.
Mm.
All the more relatable because, hey, we've all been to the dentist.
Mm-hmm.
Often accused of going too big with his performances, and check out his TV version of King Lear to see Olivier treat the scenery like an all-you-can-eat buffet. But here, he thrived on being seen as a complete actor. He worked hard at his craft and would build his characters from the outside in. Here, stripping himself of his hair, smiles, and charm to get to the center of the Nazi torturer, a terrifyingly memorable performance, and one that would define him for a new generation of filmgoers.
That's great stuff.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'd never forget that. I saw that when I was pretty young. And
yeah,
I was,
me too.
And I was just, what's going on?
Yeah.
Who is this guy? And I didn't even recognize him, you know, for a long time. I didn't realize he was the same guy. And but apart from Richard III, I think that was the first villain he played on screen.
Right.
And it was interesting that he did Boys of Brazil like a couple of years later where he played the Boys Nazi hunter.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, which is an interesting counterpoint because, again, there's a famously wonderful human being, Gregory Peck. I mean, in real life, but and also many of his film roles.
Yeah, that's right.
Very heroic, playing just a horrible, you know, playing, what was it? Was it Mingles? He played?
Yeah, that's right.
And pretty convincingly, I thought, actually. Yeah. I liked him in that film. But again, so far removed from what you're used to seeing him play.
Yeah, that's right.
Look, my final top five entry comes from a film I could happily, or perhaps unhappily, devote an entire podcast to, 1998's The Avengers. Once again, not the superhero one, but rather the misguided remake of the classic uber-British TV series. This is a film that takes perhaps the greatest cinematic hero of them all, James freaking Bond, and gives him a heel turn. That's not on the face of it a bad idea, especially if they make him decently menacing, give him a genius evil plan, and make sure he has a great hero to face off against. Alas, they make Connery dressed as a teddy bear, give him a bizarre plot that has something to do with controlling the weather, and set him against Ralph Fiennes, a man whose on-screen believability is directly related to his on-screen despicability. In other words, he's unlikable. As Mick LaSalle memorably put it in his review, if you were walking down the street and saw Fiennes and Connery brawling, which one would you root for? My guess is that half the people would stand on the sidelines rooting for Connery. The other half would jump in to help beat up Fiennes, which is pretty true. But Connery is not well served by a hammy script in a film that was brutally hacked down by about half an hour, with entire subplots reduced to confusing throwaway moments. It's really not Connery's fault that his villain outing is such a flop. He just really did pick the wrong film to turn bad in.
I've never seen this film, and I...
That's amazing to me.
I know. It just never gets played. I'm not going to hunt it down.
Sure.
So my only hope is that it turns up on TV.
Your only hope.
And I don't think... My only hope of watching this film is that it's going to turn up on TV. And I happen to, stumble across it.
Yeah, it's really, really terrible. Connery's only in it for about 10 minutes, so...
Yeah.
It's not so much that he's bad at playing a villain. It's just that the role is not great, and everything about the film is terrible.
Yeah.
But Fiennes in particular is terrible casting. He doesn't seem like a guy you can get behind.
Yeah.
And he has no chemistry with Uma Thurman.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's worse in a way in that in the original series, you never got the sense that they were romantically linked. They had a charming chemistry. But in here, of course, because of the ages of the actors, it does seem like they'd be,
Yeah.
So it becomes a little awkward.
Contemplate this on the Tree of Woe.
And welcome to one of our favourite parts of the show, the Tree of Woe. This is where we take something from our month in cinema, and something that's really irked us, and punish it by stringing it up as Conan was strung up in Conan the Barbarian to suffer under the intense heat, the burning sun, and, of course, the hungry buzzards on the Tree of Woe. So, Duncan, what's annoyed you this month?
Well, look, it's the inevitable return of the Great White Hope. When the writer came out with the concept of the Great Wall of China being built to keep something supernaturally large out of China, he must have been patting himself on the back. Now, that's a concept film. So this Chinese warrior who will lead the forces against the beast, who's that going to be played by? Matt Damon. Nailed it.
This is amazing.
Nailed it. Look, not since the obvious casting of Tom Cruise as The Last Samurai has there been an outcry against, oh no, wait, there was, of course, Keanu Reeves as the head of 47 Ronin. That was bad. Okay, so not since Keanu Reeves, oh, of course, there was half-Asian Emma Stone and Aloha.
Sure, but that's surely the only one.
Yeah. Well, there have been a lot of them, haven't there?
Tilda Swinton.
Tilda Swinton, yep. Look, I know we've talked about the whitewashing of Hollywood before, and I know it was a point of contention at the Oscars this year. I know it's an easy target, and everyone's up in arms about it, but if they can do it so many times in the face of frustration, then I can do another Tree of Woe about it. I realize why it happens. They need a name to greenlight the film, but how much longer is that excuse going to work, by the way? In the trailer, they have set it up so well. The build-up is mysterious and intriguing. Then a warrior appears from the mist, and it's Matt Damon. I actually laughed. That's not something I do with Bourne or most other things Matt Damon has done, even some of his comedy films. So why did he think this would be a great move? Probably because he thought, this film looks like a fun film. Yes, it would be, with Jet Li maybe. I'll even consider an Indonesian Iko Uwais or Thai Tony Jaa in this Chinese film. Hell, I'd take Jackie Chan in this, even if he wore his tuxedo from that film that he was in a tuxedo in. What was it called? Rumble in the Bronx. But Matty D, look, it seems like the usually astute Damon would have a nose for this controversy, especially by now. But the thing is, I don't actually care that much because it's a fantasy film from the mind of a creator who doesn't mind casting one of the whitest men alive as his hero in ancient China. That's his call. It's not like they're casting Ben Affleck as Mao Zedong. But as sad Affleck knows, people get bent out of shape when you do something as radical as cast him, a square-jawed, good-looking, straight, white American male as Batman. So they're sure going to go nuts when you cast him as the savior of an Asian nation. But you've been warned, Hollywood stars, time and again, do this thing at your own peril and on the Tree of Woe.
Oh, man, that's amazing. I remember seeing this trailer as well, and it's just I had a real problem with it as well. I can't get past it.
Yeah.
I really can't. And the thing is, a couple of years ago, there was a film starring John Cusack, also a Chinese action film set in that period. Wow. So this isn't a new thing, but there's something about Matt Damon as well. He looks, for one thing, I kind of think of Matt Damon and I think, oh, you know, you're an Oscar winner for your writing, you've done a lot of really good films. I think of you as the sort of guy who wouldn't do this thing.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's in you. So there's that, but there's also the sense that I don't buy him in a period film. I don't buy him running around in, what is this, 14th century China.
Yeah.
It's laughable to even mention it, but I just don't buy him in that era. He seems so modern. I mean, we've talked about actors who appear modern.
Yeah.
He's one of them to me.
Yeah, Kiefer Sutherland's another. And I'd say Tom Cruise is another. There's the kind of double down on Last Samurai is like Tom Cruise. I mean, he's Tom Cruise, you know. There's some things you can... Jack Reacher, okay. Mission Impossible, okay. I'm not so sure, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And stepping out of your comfort zone is fine. You know, Born on 4th of July, great. Magnolia, great. But past, I'm not sure, you know.
Yeah.
The same thing with Damon, yeah. Because I just saw it and I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Oh.
And I love the concept. I'm like, what a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Paint the wall, keeping something
It totally
up.
Is. Yeah. Tony Long would be great in this film.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, recently my esteemed colleague here, let rip on the spy action comedy film Kingsman. And here I'm about to do the same, sort of, because while he tore into an element of the film he really did not care for, I'm going to rage against an element I actually really, really liked.
Right.
Confused? Let me explain. One of the great surprises of Kingsman was Colin Firth, an actor we knew could play debonair, but never knew could play debonair and ass-kickery. And what ass-kickery? Especially in the film's standout action scene, a deliriously brutal church massacre that saw headshots and broken bodies aplenty as Firth mowed down wave after wave of parishioners. That giddy action scene was followed immediately by another shocking moment when Firth is, spoiler alert for something you should already know, folks, killed off by the film's villain. It's a brave filmmaking choice, a rare one as we've both often opined, to kill off a major and popular character. This doesn't happen that often. And this isn't one of those fake outy leave the door open for return deaths either. Firth is clearly killed on screen, end of story.
Mm-hmm.
Except, of course, no. You see, there's a sequel on the way, and Firth is coming back. And it doesn't matter how they play this, whether it's the long-lost twin brother of Harry Hart, some top-secret cloning program, or any one of a million other daffy explanations. This is just a case of another deathless movie copping out on killing a character. Firth's death in the first film was a ballsy decision, one that helped cement the film's perception as a clever and unique twist on the genre. A perception that's now looking more than a little bit shaky in my mind. Because if the film doesn't have the guts to stand by one of its few unique twists, what's left? You know, a crude anal sex joke, some ropey CGI, and some admittedly fun violence. But look, death, as I've said so many times before, needs to be taken seriously in these films. And to help the filmmakers understand why death needs to be taken seriously, we're not going to let them die. We're going to let them suffer. Up there on the tree of woe, the buzzards will explain the rest.
Yeah, wow. That's depressing that they've gone down that road.
Yeah, and
surely you could have got someone else. You know, like, hey, we need a Colin Firth-esque another guy. English guy. It's not like you're running out of dapper English guys you could put in there.
Yeah.
Why do you need Colin Firth?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you need a mentor guy, you're not too convinced you want to put it to this to the young actor. And let him carry it all. I kind of get that. We've got Mark Strong in this film as well. He survived at the end of it. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
You know, he's a decent enough kind of English actor, so I don't know.
It was a cool moment, killing off.
It was. In fact, that massacre scene and that death, that couple of minutes, was that elevated that film to me. I was just giddy. I was like, I can't believe I'm watching this.
Because
I didn't expect it in that film. Sure, the film was a little bit edgy and a little bit racy, a little bit different, but that was another level. And it really did make me like that film, so that the end did bug me. I was like, oh, well, that was cheap. But now that you're telling me that that's all just...
Yeah, it makes me think worse of the film itself, even though it's not that film's fault in many ways. But it's frustrating to see that they've done this.
Yeah, and so Matthew Vaughn's doing that as well?
Actually, I don't know,
right,
to be honest. I think so. I would assume so, but I'm not sure.
Spoiler alert.
So that's spoiler alert for this month. Thanks to everyone for listening. Simon, what was your favourite movie of the month?
I'm going to say All That Heaven Allows, actually, surprisingly.
Right, okay.
I thought this was gorgeous. It was whip smart. Wyman and Rock Hudson were great. It's a real product of its time. I think a lot of people might find it a little bit inaccessible.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really worth giving a go to. It looks beautiful. The colour palette, everything about it is gorgeous.
Okay.
And it's got a lovely dark kind of take on American consumerism and the conservatism of the time.
Right.
All being quite a conservative looking film to some degrees, if you know what I mean. Hands down my favourite. How about yourself?
I think I've got to go for Perfect Strangers, the Italian film. I think that there was another one at the film festival that proved to be a hit. They put on extra screenings of it, and hopefully it will turn up at Rialto or a few other places.
Oh, cool.
I think that, like I say, some of the things, the revelations and things are a little bit timely contrived, but I think that it was really, I didn't expect much of it, I think. So maybe I'm kind of being counterproductive here by telling people to go and see it. But I really liked it. The performance was really good. It was really funny. And also it's probably one of those ones that is a good kind of universal film that you could probably put on for anyone you're with, you know, and watch it. And it's entertaining. I thought that particularly the performances were great. So check that out, Perfect Strangers. And like I say, try and see it before they muck it up in American.
yeah, perfect.
And the song we're going out to, Simon?
This is from Stage Fright. Like I said, Stage Fright, not a great film. Good opening and one really solid musical number, and which we're going to play a piece of now. We're Gay. From the movie Stage Fright.
Okay, and what's the song we're going out to?
Look, anyone who listens to it knows that part, man.
We're Gay for movies.
Yep.
No, yeah, fantastic. So thanks to everyone for listening.
Yep, thank you.
We will see you all next month.
All right, take care.
Cheers.
I'm gay, but not in that way. Musicals move me and touch me in ways I can't say.
He's gay, but not in that way.
I sleep with women, but musicals make me feel gay.
I'm gay, I'm actually gay. I don't get hard when I see TNA. Could be my DNA or how I was raised.
We don't distinguish here at Center Stage.
We're all gay, we're gay in all kinds of ways.
Some in the bedroom
and some cause of musical plays.
Is it safe?
Look, I tell you, I can't do it.